One of my favorite movies growing up was Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. It was the third and what should have been the final installment of the Indiana Jones franchise. And it centers around the pursuit of the Holy Grail. The Holy Grail, that legendary cup that Jesus drank from during the Last Supper and that supposedly Joseph of Arimathea gathered his blood in at the crucifixion. And they're searching for it in this movie. And at the end of the movie, the bad guys catch up to Indy and they find this old Knights of Templar who is guarding the Grail. And the Grail is set up on a table amongst a variety of goblets. And the villain steps in and he asks, "Which one is it?" To which the guardian responds, "You must choose, but choose wisely. For as the true Grail will bring you life, the false Grail will take it from you." And if you've seen the film, you know he chose poorly. Everyone who goes out into the world faces a similar choice, a similar situation. Various philosophies are paraded before us on a daily basis, each claiming to have the answers, each claiming to be the way to happiness, the way to satisfaction, the way to fulfillment, each claiming to offer life. And the question that lies before each person is, which one is it? How is one to know which is the way to life and which will take it from you? Since we must choose, how can we choose wisely? Today, we're going to begin our study of what Bruce Waltke has called the black sheep of the canon of biblical books, the delight of skeptics and the despair of saints. The book that he was referring to was the book of Ecclesiastes. So if you want to meet me there, we will be in the book of Ecclesiastes. It is a contentious book. Almost every aspect of it is debated, from its authorship to its message, which is partly why some call it the most misunderstood book of the Bible. I tend to agree. I had to chuckle. I was doing some searching online just to see what some other folks might say about the book. I went to Wikipedia to see what it had to say about the message, and it said this: "Scholars disagree whether it is positive and life-affirming or deeply pessimistic, whether it is coherent or incoherent, insightful or confused, orthodox or heterodox, whether the ultimate message of the book is to copy Qoheleth, the wise man, or to avoid his errors." I mean, you know you've got problems if you've made it to the end of a story and you are not sure if the moral of the story is be like the main character or don't be like the main character. You are confused. Well, we're going to make it our ambition today to discern the meaning of this book. We don't want to be confused while we work through it. We want to know where this story is headed. We want to know exactly what we're supposed to take from this story. We want to grasp the big picture so that we can understand what the author says and we can take away what the author wants us to take away from this book. So this morning, I just want to look at the introduction and the conclusion, the beginning and the end. And we're going to start right in the first chapter with the first verse. "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities," says the preacher. "Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What advantage does man have in all his work, which he does under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Also, the sun rises and the sun sets, and hastening to its place, it rises there again. Blowing towards the south, then turning towards the north, the wind continues swirling along on its circular courses, and the wind returns. All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. All things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is that which will be. And that which has been done is that which will be done. There's nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which one might say, see this? It is new. Already it's existed for ages which were before us. There is no remembrance of earlier things, and also of the later things which will occur. There will be for them no remembrance among those who will come later still. I read this somewhat pessimistic sounding message, and I ask the question, who is the speaker? Verse 1 introduces us to the main character of the book from whom the name Ecclesiastes is taken. Translations variously render him as the teacher or the preacher, or Eugene Peterson's The Message renders it the quester. And I kind of like that one, the quester. The Hebrew word is actually Kohelet. And this book, Ecclesiastes, is the only place that that word appears. And because of that, we don't really know what that word means. See, if in the New Testament, when you're dealing with Koine Greek, there are all kinds of other documents written in Greek. So if you have a word that appears once in Scripture, you can say, well, let's see what other writings, how this term is employed there, and maybe we can discern the meaning. Not so with Hebrew. We don't have that luxury. The Bible is the only document of that age in Hebrew that we have. So we have to guess at it. Now, fortunately, we know that it's a title because at the end of the book, there's going to be an article before it, the Kohelet. So it's a title of some sort. The name itself, Ecclesiastes, that's Greek. It comes from the Septuagint's translation of Kohelet. So when the Jewish authors came and they were going to translate this book into Greek, they chose the word ekklesia, dealing with an assembly. So Ecclesiastes is talking about a member within an assembly. It's the same word, by the way, that the New Testament will use for the church. The church is the ekklesia. So I think of Christ's discussion with Peter, you know, on this rock I will build my ecclesia, my church. So we might imagine this individual as a preacher preaching to an assembly. He's giving a message. And if the authors of the Septuagint's translation is correct, then that Hebrew word, Kohelet, likely comes from the word kahal. Kahal, which just means assembly. Interestingly, we'll find that word in places like Genesis 35:11. And in Genesis 35, that's where God is changing Jacob's name. He says, your name will now be Israel. And God tells him in Genesis 35:11, a nation and a kahal of nations shall come from you. An assembly of nations, a church of nations. The Septuagint translates it, a synagogue of nations. I wonder what that might be talking about that's going to come from Israel, a synagogue of nations. Anyways, much of what we read comes from the mouth of this individual that I'm going to call the preacher, because that's what the NASB calls it, and I think that it'll just be easiest. The preacher. Now, some think that the preacher is Solomon and that he's the author of this book. In fact, some of your translations may just come out and say that. It may just put Solomon right in there. The text never says that, but boy, it's going to get close. Because when we're going to look at the description of this preacher, verse 1 tells us he is the son of David, king in Jerusalem. And as we go through the book, we're going to find that this individual had more gold and more women and more prosperity than anybody else before him, along with more wisdom. Oh, and by the way, he composed a lot of Proverbs and wrote a lot of Proverbs. I'm thinking of these things. I said, gee, that sounds familiar. I know somebody like that. But with descriptions like that, I can't help but ask. I mean, if you're trying to make me think of Solomon here, why don't you just say it? If you want me to be thinking of Solomon, just say so. Seems like you're going to a lot of effort to not say Solomon while saying Solomon. It seems like the omission is somewhat intentional here. Why? Regardless, we know that we're dealing with a speaker here, a preacher, and he has a message. What is the message? Well, like any good preacher, he leads with his point, which we find in verse 2. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Or your text might say, meaningless, meaningless, everything is meaningless. The word havel, it just means it is a breath, it is a vapor. There's nothing to it. It's something that quickly goes away. He's saying that everything is like that. But I'll tell you something that's interesting about this word, havel. As y'all know, in Hebrew, there weren't originally vowels. You know, they just had the consonants. The vowel pointings, that came much later. And when you look at this word, havel, it's made up of three consonants, he, bet, lamed. And if you were a Hebrew reader, you would recognize those letters. They actually come from much earlier in the story. It's a name. It's the name that we're all familiar with. Havel, 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 Abel, Abel. The root is the exact same name as Abel. And as you recall, you know, you think of the story of Abel. He's the son of that original couple. Adam and Eve had Cain and Abel. And I think about Abel. He is a keeper of flocks. He offered a sacrifice that was pleasing to the Lord. He's one of the few biblical characters that we ever meet in this story that doesn't have anything negative said about him. And yet, what was his reward for his faith? He died. He went to the dirt. Death. His wicked brother killed him, and then he went off and had a kid and built a city. End of story. And it just seems like, you know, what was the point of it all? And the author seems to be saying he's going to draw much from Genesis here. I think he's likely saying, Abel, Abel. Everything's Abel. Everything is like that. Everything is, from all appearances, meaningless. You say, whoa, whoa, whoa. What you trying to say, preacher? This isn't the message that I was expecting today. What is meaningless? Verse 3. All man's work, which he does under the sun. Or he'll say later, he'll describe it as that which is done under heaven. It's all meaningless. It's all chasing after the wind. It's all a complete waste of time. Now, I imagine a message like this would get quite a reaction from an assembly. It's not exactly the prosperity gospel. It's not a poverty gospel either. This is the pointless gospel. Everything's pointless. Our pastor might need a sabbatical. You know, he's starting to get burnt out on us, I think, guys. He's sounding a bit nihilistic. He's lost the plot. Everything is meaningless, he says. So if you're sitting there and you're listening to this, my question is, what is the author's point? Or rather, what is the punchline of the preacher's message? Why is this included in the scriptures? Why will we have this long sermon in our text? What's the punchline? And as y'all know, because y'all have been with me for a long time now, the best way to find out where someone is going is to cheat. Right? We go to the end. We say, all right, we're just going to skip straight to the end. It doesn't matter if it's a story. It doesn't matter if it's a news article. You go to the end of it to find out what they're trying to say. And when you find out where they're going, then you can go back and see, okay, this is how you wanted me to get there. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to cheat. We're going to go to the end of Ecclesiastes. Meet me there in chapter 12. And I want to look at verse 9 through 14. Well, you know, I'll back up one verse for you. Verse 8. Ecclesiastes 12, verse 8. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. All is vanity. In addition to being a wise man, the preacher also taught the people knowledge. And he pondered, searched out, and arranged many proverbs. The preacher sought to find delightful words and to write the words of truth correctly. The words of wise men are like goads, and masters of these collections are like well-driven nails. They are given by one shepherd. But beyond this, my son, be warned. The writing of many books is endless, and excessive devotion to books is wearying to the body. The conclusion, when all is heard, is, fear God and keep his commandments, because this applies to every person. For God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. Now, when I look at this, the first thing that jumps out to me is I notice verse 9, the preacher is not the narrator. The preacher is not the one telling the story. There's another person here. There's another voice who has been speaking. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they aren't the same person in real life. I think of situations like in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, Paul will speak of his own experience. He'll say, I knew a man 14 years ago who was caught up into the third heaven. Whether in the body or out of the body, I don't know. But he's really giving his own testimony. He's separating himself, though, so as not to give himself glory, not to be bragging about it. Because he distances it, so he talks about a character, another person. But he's really meaning himself. So it could be the same person. But for the sake of this book, it's important to note that the story has a narrator, and the narrator is not the preacher. The preacher is just a character in the narrator's story. Well, then the next question must be, who is the narrator? Who is the one that has been speaking to us from the beginning? Well, it's not a pastor teacher speaking to an assembly. Notice that verse 12, the narrator is a father instructing his son. Just like in the Proverbs, chapters 1 through 9, we saw it opened up, and it was a father and a mother trying to teach his son. They were trying to pass down the family jewels. They were trying to impart wisdom to the son so that he would grow up and choose wisely. In the same way, we have a father here, and he's trying to instruct his son, but in Ecclesiastes, he's using a different method. He's not addressing the exact same issue as the father in Proverbs was. So he's using a different method. He's telling a story. And the punchline to the story is found in verse 13 and 14. Fear God, keep his commandments, because he's the judge. That is where this book is going. That is the intended takeaway for the son that the previous 11 and a half chapters are leading to. If the son rightly understands, if he hears, if he listens, if he accepts the moral of the story that has been building for 11 chapters, his conclusion will be, fear God and keep his commandments because God is going to judge everybody. Fear God and keep his commandments as opposed to what? I think the answer to that question is actually found in the identification of the group with which the preacher is dealing. If you'll meet me back in chapter 1. The preacher is speaking, we've already mentioned it, of the futility, the meaninglessness, the uselessness of man's work, which he does under the sun. And in verse 12, the preacher actually begins his message. All right, verse 1 through 11, that's the narrator. Verse 12, here comes the character, here comes the preacher. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I set my mind to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. The sons of men. who is this group? Well, the first time we meet this group, again, is going to be in the book of Genesis. Surprise, surprise. It's actually in Genesis chapter 11. We have a construction work going on, a building job. They're trying to build a tower that reaches to heaven, and we find in chapter 11, verse 5, the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. They're the folks over here that are trying to gather together to keep from being scattered, to oppose the will of God in spreading out throughout the earth. They want to make a name for themselves. That's what the sons of men are up to. And interestingly, as we track this group throughout scriptures, it is almost always referenced negatively. And it's almost always in the future talking about Gentiles. Consider Ephesians. Listen to how Paul will talk about this group. This is Ephesians chapter 3. Ephesians chapter 3, verse 1, we read, "Look, for this reason, I, Paul, the prisoner of Christ Jesus for the sake of you Gentiles, if indeed you have heard of the stewardship of God's grace which was given to me for you, that by revelation there was made known to me the mystery, as I wrote before in brief. By referring to this, when you read, you can understand my insight into the mystery of Christ, which in other generations was not made to the sons of men, as it has now been revealed to his holy apostles in the Spirit, to be specific, that the Gentiles are fellow heirs and fellow members of the body and fellow partakers of the promise in Christ Jesus through the gospel." Was Gentile inclusion predicted to the Jews in the Old Testament? Well, we just read one verse where it was. Genesis 35:11 says, "A church of nations is coming from you." Remember Deuteronomy 32. "All right, Jews, since you guys made me jealous with that which is not a god, I'm going to make you jealous with a people that's not a people." Yes, it's in there. But the Gentiles, they don't know anything about any of this. They don't have any revelation. Paul's going to say, there you were, separated from God's people, separated from the covenant of promise, without hope and without God in the world. You didn't have revelation. You didn't have a shot. And now I'm coming to bring it to you so you can get in on this thing. I think of how Paul used the term there. Sons of men, you guys who were on the outside. Listen to how the preacher will describe this group throughout the book. We already mentioned verse 13, where he mentions the grievous task which God has given to the sons of men to be afflicted with. In chapter 2, verse 3, he begins to explain what he's attempting to accomplish. And he says, "I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine while my mind was guiding me wisely, and how to take hold of folly until I could see what good there was, or what good there is for the sons of men to do under heaven the few years of their lives." I'm going out there to see what's going on in Gentile land, and I want to see, what is there for them to do? What has God given them to occupy their time? Chapter 3, verse 10. "I've seen the task which God has given to the sons of men with which to occupy themselves," to keep them busy. And ultimately he's going to say, so they can't figure out what he's been up to. Verse 18. "I said to myself concerning the sons of men, God surely tested them in order for them to see that they're but beasts. For the fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, they all have the same breath, and there's no advantage for man over beast. It's all vanity. They all go to the same place, all came from the dust, and all return to the dust." There you are. Man was created to represent God, to rule on his behalf. It's what distinguishes us from the animals. It's what places us over the animals. You may recall the story of Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel chapter 4. Nebuchadnezzar, who lifted himself up. Okay, he became haughty and proud because of the magnificence of his kingdom. He didn't recognize that it is the Most High who rules over the realm of mankind, and he gives it to whom he wants. So what does God do? He humbles him. He takes away his reason, and Nebuchadnezzar goes out into the field and begins eating grass like a beast. And he stays there among the beasts until he recognizes the Most High, at which time he is restored. And my opinion of that whole tale is it's given and it's recorded for Israel's sake, because of Israel's position. So Israel has been placed under the beast nations in Daniel, right? They're supposed to rule over the beasts. It's the national image bearer. And now they've been subjected to the beast. Why? Because they became proud and did not recognize it was God who had been raising them up, who had been gifting them with their sovereignty and with their produce and all that. They thought the nations did it. So he takes it away and he puts them under the beast nations. He does it with Nebuchadnezzar and restores him so that the Israelites will recognize, yeah, if we just recognize our God again and our King David, he'll restore us too. So I think of this description. He said, you Gentiles out there, you're no really different than animals. Following your instincts. You're not operating based on God's word or his wisdom. You can't even do that. You're just like beasts. No difference. And you're going to the same place. I think of chapter 8. Verse 11. Because the sentence against an evil deed is not executed quickly, therefore the hearts of the son of men among them are fully given to do evil. That under heaven language, the first time it appears, is right before the flood. And the Lord's looking at what the sons of men, literally it's the sons of Adam in both these places. We're talking about the sons of men. They have multiplied and filled the earth. So we're like, okay, that's great. But all they filled the earth with is violence. Their hearts are given only to do evil. And because judgment has not come down, because remember, our God is long-suffering, he is slow to anger, because they're not seeing the judgment immediately fall when someone does something bad, they're like, well, I guess we can get away with it. There is no coming judgment. He says, the sons of men among them, they're given fully to do evil because of that. They don't take the time to repent or change their course. They just go farther in. Or lastly, I think of the two places it pops up in chapter 9. Verse 3, there's an evil that's done under the sun. There's one fate for all men. Furthermore, the hearts of the sons of men are full of evil and insanity. Insanity is in their hearts throughout their lives. Afterwards, they go to the dead. Verse 12, moreover, man doesn't know his time. He's like a fish caught in a treacherous net and birds trapped in a snare. So the sons of men are ensnared at an evil time when it suddenly falls on them. So I think of this group, the sons of men, and the preacher who has wisdom already. He previously has wisdom, which I'm thinking knowledge of the character of God. He knows what's good. He knows what's evil. But he takes his wisdom with him and he goes to the sons of men. He goes into the world to see what they're up to see what's good under heaven, to see where they're finding life at, and to evaluate it. So I think about this, and I consider the story about the preacher's search for meaning and life and good in this Gentile land. And I ask, why would this be important for the author to relay to his son? This is all a story. It's all something the author, the father, is relaying to his son to make an impact on him. Why? Why, after telling this to the son, would the son accept the conclusion, okay, I should fear God and keep his commandments? What is the problem that the book of Ecclesiastes was written to deal with? It's a problem that every believing parent deals with. The coming of age. One day your child's going to grow up and they're going to go out into the world and they're going to be presented with varieties of views different from the ones you gave them when they grew up under your roof. Differing philosophies, different ideas about where life is, where happiness is, where satisfaction is, where meaning is. Alternative philosophies, and the people that give them are going to be impressive to them. They're going to be people that are in positions of authority over them. Professors, bosses, friends, peers. and they have to choose. And you want them to choose wisely. You want them to stay the course. You want them to keep the faith. So what do you do? How do you prepare them? You got to tell them what's down the road. You tell them where those philosophies lead. You don't hide them from the philosophies. You preemptively introduce them to the philosophies. See, the book of Ecclesiastes is a coming of age tale. It's a big world out there. One day, the sun is going to wonder what's going on in Gentile land. I mean, that is the problem for Israel all the way through the story, is it not? They're supposed to rule over the Gentiles and bless the Gentiles with the knowledge of their Messiah, the only place that life is found. But all throughout the story, they don't want to do that. They want to be like the Gentiles. They want to go after the Gentiles. They love their women. They love their gods. They want to be just like them. Father's saying, don't do that. There's no life in Gentile land. No life out there. You know, this son's going to go out there. He's going to hear some, you know, highfalutin talk. Somebody that sounds good, that has the rhetoric. And he's going to say, you know, maybe mom and pop didn't know so much. Maybe this is where life is. And Father's saying, son, let me save you some heartache. Somebody's already done that. Been there, done that. There's nothing there. Big fat waste of time. And the way that he does that is through the preacher. The preacher that he never outright names as Solomon, though it's clear through the description that he's wanting his son to think of this individual. He's wanting him to think. Now, whether this is actually Solomon talking to his son and saying, son, I did all this, but he's not, but he doesn't want to put himself there, but he is. Or whether it's someone else down the road, it's irrelevant. The point is, what he's trying to say is, the man with the most access, the best ability to see what was out there, the wisest one among us, the richest one among us, he spent his life trying to just find something out there, something of value. At the end of the day, it's just a big fat waste of time. Don't waste your life seeking life where life cannot be found. That's what he's saying. So I think about this book and I ask the question, what about us? What does a book such as Ecclesiastes have for us in the 21st century? Well, as the preacher says, there ain't nothing new under the sun. The wisdom of Satan that permeates our world today, it's the same thing that's been around for generations and generations. Postmodernism began at the fall. The question that Satan began with was, did God really say, look, you eat from that fruit, you can be like God. You can call it for yourself. You can do what's good for you, and I'll do what's good for me. That was there at the beginning. This ain't nothing new. And the benefit is, if we know that these philosophies that get repackaged and repackaged, you know, they're like zombies, you know, they come up in a generation and a generation finally slays them, only for a generation or two down the road that's forgotten to resurrect them, put a new name on them, and then accept them. Even though they're coming back, the benefit that we have is, if they've been introduced generations ago, they've been answered generations ago. The answers are already there. You know, we have to learn, we have to gain from those who came before us. Take from their experience and their wisdom. Secondly, I would say that the concern of the narrator, it is a concern for every believing parent today. We're in his situation. If you have kids, if you have grandkids, you want them to be able to stand on their own. You can't be there with them forever. Now, believing parents have answered this in various ways. I know that the generation before me, it was very popular, and I know many, many kids who grew up in this, is the answer to a hostile world is to shelter your kids, to protect them from the world. If we can create an environment that we remove all these negative influences for them and let them grow up till they're 18 and then we send them out into the world, then they'll be able to stand. That does not work. That's like taking someone, you know, you want someone to be healthy, so you put them in a bubble and you keep them from all of the different viruses and pathogens and all of that in the world, And then one day you just release them. Well, they're not going to have an immune system to deal with it. And they're just going to get eaten alive. I have friends that I grew up with in high school, eaten alive because of that. They were not prepared for the questions that the world had, the philosophies. The other side of that, some people just let them do whatever they want. Well, it's just they're going to have to deal with it anyway, so I might as well just let them go do what they want. No. We do want to protect our kids, but it's not just in a sheltering way. We want to prepare them. The world's going to be there. It's waiting for them. The best thing that we can do for them then is to be there alongside them, raising them, introducing them to these foolish philosophies while you're at least in a controlled environment that you can discuss it with them. So that by the time that they're old enough and they can go out, they can stand on their own. All right, Satan's there waiting for them. We have to be diligent. We have to be vigilant. If you want your kids to stand, you got to have answers to these questions. And you got to be open to talking with them about it. You got to know why you believe what you believe and not that. And it's not just because, you know, Caleb said so or somebody else said so. Why do you say that, Dad? Mom? Grandma? Why do you believe? Well, I believe Jesus is the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. Let me tell you why, son. We walk them through it. The book of Ecclesiastes is a very relevant book. It is a very contemporary book. It is timeless because the threats that we face are timeless.